This is a new podcast episode of Real Sciences Podcast, and in this episode we are welcoming Professor Stefano Biardi, Professor of Philosophy in Al-Akhawain University in Morocco. He's interested in research about Islam and science, religious movements, movies and philosophy, and ancient aliens. His research interests are usually very close to the topics that we are interested in real sciences. Welcome, Dr. Stefano, and I hope I pronounced your name correctly in the two times.
Yes, pronunciation was perfect. Thank you so much, and thank you for the invite and for the introduction. I think you already have mentioned the essential. Indeed, I'm a professor of philosophy at Al-Akhawain University in Ifrane, in Morocco. This since 2016, fall 2016. By education, I am a scholar in the philosophy of science. I graduated in philosophy with a focus on philosophy of science from the University of Bologna, where I did my PhD too. And then I was serving at different institutions the world over until I got an offer from AUI, where I am happily serving as associate professor. I've been specializing in the debate on religion and science with a focus on Islam and modern science. Then 10 years ago, I started studying new religious movements and science as well. And well, if you wonder like how I work, like what my methodology is, I would say that I have two hats. On the one hand, I'm a sort of historian of ideas or ethnographer, in the sense that I reconstruct the debate quite neutrally from outside, also engaging in interviews with the participants in the debate. This is one of the advantages of studying modern authors, right? You can send them an email, you can interact with them, but still I'm a philosopher at heart, you can say, and therefore when needed, I also engage in critique and criticism of ideas, always respectfully, of course, and always staying within my area of competence.
And we are interested in your main publications, your path. That how did you come to this path of studying particularly these topics? And maybe worthy to mention, after you pronounced the word Akhawain, way that you speak Arabic also.
Sure, yeah. Well, I'd rather say Darija, Moroccan Arabic. Okay, it's a long story, in fact, but I try to summarize it. As you may know, in Italy, being Italy a secular country, religious education is optional. And when I was a kid, my parents opted me out of religious education and primary school. So while my my schoolmates, my classmates were taking religious education, I would take something else. I mean, I would spend time in a classroom nearby. And the other one who was not taking religious education was an Egyptian kid, a girl by the name of Adir, who, by the way, is currently a journalist. And yeah, she would talk to me about Egypt. She would talk to me about Arabic. And my interest started, in fact, with Arabic, which I perceived as an interesting intellectual challenge. So later on, while I already was a university student, I started studying Arabic first at university in a sort of course that was parallel to my like official studies. And then I traveled to Egypt multiple times to study Arabic in Alexandria and also to teach Italian. And that's how I got exposed to ideas on Islam and modern science, and then I decided to research, to investigate for my postdoc, so after completing my PhD. So that was the story in a nutshell.
That's very interesting. And we may say something in the end. We may ask you to say something to the Moroccan audience or the Maghribi audience by the end of this podcast. What I want to ask...
Maybe by the end, if I'm not too tired.
Yes,
I have to say that meanwhile, I have become more proficient in Islam and modern science than I have in Arabic. But okay.
It's very interesting. And it's kind of a new form of Orientalism. I wanted to ask you about your book, The Crescent and the Split Moon, or La Mesa Luna and La Luna de Mezata. I wish that we see this book translated to Arabic one day. My first question is, what attracted you to study the relationship between science and religion, particularly for Islam?
Okay, my interest in religion perhaps stems from the fact that I was not raised religious. So maybe the more you are deprived of something, the more you get interested in it. Interest in Islam, it's because maybe it wasn't mainstream. I think that my interest peaked when, in the aftermath of 9/11, when everyone basically was talking against Islam and they wanted to do something different. I wanted to study it respectfully. And I also started wondering whether the debate in the Muslim world would be different or similar to that among Christians. Although, again, meanwhile, I have grown more competent in the Muslim debate rather than in the Christian one. Talking about that book, and by the way, you pronounce it perfectly, again, I published it in 2018, so it's already a few years ago. And that's a book focusing on pseudoscience in the Muslim world. So there is this huge conversation on Islam and modern science. For those who are not familiar with it, I can summarize it as follows. There is a contemporary debate on Islam and science where you have 1,000 voices, including voices of Muslim scientists, so people who have studied and do actual science in the lab at university, and they all agree over some generic facts or ideas. So they will all tell you that Islam highly values ilm, which is science and knowledge and science more in particular. They will tell you that the Quran encourages people to observe the natural world. They will all agree that there was a golden era of Islam during which science would flourish in Muslim countries. But then when it comes to the details of the harmony of Islam and science, they are in deep disagreement. So there are many controversial issues, including, for instance, miracles or evolution or the ethos of science and so on. And that's what I find fascinating to reconstruct. Within this big conversation, there is an ongoing, I would say, not so visible, but not so minor either, conversation on Islam and pseudoscience. That is, there are certain authors who call other ones pseudoscientific, or in other words, who claim that other ones are advocating the harmony of Islam and science, but in fact, what they are doing is a form of fake science. And this is what I find highly interesting. The book that I published in 2018 focuses on Islam and pseudoscience. And, well, you were mentioning Orientalism before. In this book, one of the general observations that I draw at the end is that, in fact, pseudoscience in the Muslim world doesn't have anything special. I mean, of course, the forms of pseudoscience that you have do refer to the Quran. So in a sense, they are distinctly Islamic. But if you analyze the structure of the arguments that are being used, or if you look at historical connections, you will see that all forms of pseudoscience are similar. So at the end of the day, there is nothing essentially special about pseudoscience in the Muslim world.
That is compared to pseudoscience within a Christian world, for example?
Yes. Yeah, let me just provide you with a couple of examples. One of the discourses on Islam and science that is labeled as pseudoscientific by Muslim critics as the so-called Ijaz Ilmi, so the scientific miraculousness of the Quran, the idea that the Quran contains very precise scientific information that, of course, was not available at the time of revelation, and that would be proof of the divine origin of the Quran. Again, this is a very popular discourse. I find it a lot in school. I find it a lot among my students, for instance. But there are Muslim scientists who criticize it, right? Of course, since it makes reference to the Quran, you would say that this is distinctly Islamic. But if you look at other religions, you will find that similar claims are made by theologians and authors in general, representatives of other religions. You will find, for instance, similar claims concerning the sacred scriptures of the Mormons, just to mention one new religious movement. Another case, Islamic creationism. Of course, the book of Genesis, so in the Bible, and the Quran do not totally overlap. So there are certain theological concerns that are not shared across Islam and Christianity. Islam is not concerned, is not really interested, for instance, in the original sin, right? You don't have that narrative. But there are similarities, including the story of Adam and Eve. And historically, it is demonstrated that prominent Muslim creationists, think of Harun Yahya or Adnan Oktar, the Turkish creationist, have been literally copying and pasting from Christian creationists. So again, there are very strong links that like speak against like an exceptional character of pseudoscience in the Muslim world.
I was about to ask about how something like Ijaz is viewed from outside the Muslim world, but I think you already answered this. Well, just about the comparison, isn't Quran or Islamic texts in general more generic, that doesn't include the same level of details that the Old Testament talks about, which gives more freedom to Muslim scholars in making a relationship with science? There was, for example, at some time in the times when they were Al-Mu'tazila, there were some something that was called later by Orientalists the Muhammadian evolutionary theory, which is the Islamic evolutionary theory, which is not scientific, but it was the text, as I see it, was kind of generic to the extent that people were able to out of the limits of the text.
I would say that if there is a difference, it's a difference that is in quantity rather than in quality. It is a fact that the Quran makes very frequent reference to natural phenomena. Then again, one has to inspect the language of those references and decide whether they really are that precise, that accurate. And also, I would say that in comparison with similar discourses or similar ideas among Christians, Ijaz Ilmi is immensely popular. It's much more popular among Muslims than similar ideas among Christians. But again, it's a matter of degree, I would say, of quantity. That answers the question.
Yes, yeah. I think that's a valid point. It also may correlate with how religious usually are, although we are talking about two different religions, but how are Muslims actually more religious, more practicing their religion, or their religions taking more size in their life than Christians?
Well, consider this. Most of my students, when I ask them about Ijaz Ilmi, by the way, I haven't mentioned this, but I regularly teach a course on Islam and modern science. So obviously, I always start with a conversation with my students, and I ask them, in your opinion, is there harmony between Islam and science? And they say yes, and then invariably, almost invariably, they give me examples of scientific miraculousness. And then I ask them, where do you get this idea from? And usually, well, it's videos, it's TV programs, but it's also school. They have heard about this in school, and not just from teachers of religious education, but from teachers of science, of scientific subjects. In secular countries, I cannot think of anything of this sort. So maybe there is, at some level, the same kind of idea of a thesis, but it doesn't trickle down to school, and it doesn't get the same kind of diffusion.
I notice the title of your book and the picture on the book, which is the half moon. Is that, does that refer to the idea of the Islamic Ijaz on the fracture that's in the moon, and that there's, the story goes like that NASA discovered there is a fracture in the moon, and that's coming from some verse in the Quran?
Yes, actually, I told you earlier that I was exposed to ideas on Islam and science during one of my stays in Alexandria, Egypt. And one of those was precisely the narrative of the splitting of the moon. We had this very good Arabic teacher who would also teach us Arabic based on the Quran. So we came across the ayat about the splitting of the moon. And, well, he commented that NASA scientists had discovered proof of this. And this is very interesting because, you know, on the one hand, you have a supernatural miracle. Of course, if the moon was ever split, then there had to be an interruption of the laws of nature. At the same time, what is claimed is that a scientific expedition, a scientific mission, verified this, and there is also this picture circulating that, in fact, represents what is called a real. So, yeah, it's a fracture of sorts, but it's only superficial, and it doesn't go around the whole moon, and it's no sign at all of a past complete fracture of our satellite. So, yeah, this is a sort of supernatural miracle and scientific miracle combined. And what I also find fascinating is that in order to subscribe to this narrative, you also have to go against another very popular conspiracy theory, that is the moon landing theory, according to which nobody ever set foot on the moon. So, of course, if they had to check that, then they had to be there as well. So that's why I decided to have it on the cover. I mean, it was important for me. It was being exposed to that narrative was an important step in my research. It's an interesting example. Conceptually speaking, it conflates many elements. And also, I thought it would make for an excellent illustration.
So this religious narrative is part of the culture, but also something else that you're interested in, which is the movies, and is maybe more essential part of the culture for many youth now. And you studied that. You studied how fiction works, like Omega Man. It can impact our sense of perception of science. So how do you compare this to religion? And can we say, for example, that movies are more impactful, or how does this, the relationship goes based on maybe different types of people?
Well, you are mentioning now an article that I wrote a couple of years ago. I think it was COVID time, coronavirus time. So I had a lot of time to watch movies and analyze them and write articles about them. To be honest, although it's my article, it's not very fresh in my mind as of now. But I can tell you in general that movies, science fiction movies, can play different roles. Sometimes they are used to express a certain perception or conception of science. If I remember well, this movie, which is a post-apocalyptic one, is quite pessimistic about science, but it's also optimistic in that, you know, humanity is wiped out by, if I remember well, some kind of conflict, nuclear conflict. But then, like a cure is also found. So it's like a picture in black and white of science. But science fiction movies can play a great role also in inspiring interest in science. Sometimes interest in scientific topics can be sparked, for instance, by a series like Star Trek or Star Wars. They always play multiple roles. It's a way of expressing perceptions of science, but it's a way of inspiring certain perceptions of science as well.
It's a critical area where you can move your imagination about science, but in the same time, believing any of these may plant some non-scientific ideas. Other book, The New Religious Movements and Science, you talked about five movements when you analyzed them. I think our audience would be highly interested in knowing more about these movements, such as Scientology.
Okay, so thank you so much for mentioning my most recent book. It was published in our Cambridge University Press series, Elements in New Religious Movements. So basically what I'm doing in this case is analyzing the debate over religion and science, but from a different perspective. Now, focus is not on Islam, nor is it on Christianity, but it's on new religious movements that are also known at a popular level as sects or cults. But scholars, for various reasons, prefer the expression new religious movements. And what I do, especially in the first half of this book, is analyzing five case studies. So let's see if I'm able to remember all of them. I analyze Scientology, then the Raelian movement, then a Satanist group that was active in Italy, then Santo Daime, which is a new religious movement that originated in Brazil, but meanwhile it has gone global, and finally Falun Gong, which is a new religious movement that originated in China, and meanwhile, likewise, it has gone global. And for each one of them, I scrutinize how they conceptualize the relation with science, the different ways they have to conceptualize science. Now, to elaborate a bit more on Scientology, which is perhaps the one that public is most familiar with, Scientology was created by a science fiction writer, L. Ron Hubbard, who claimed that he had discovered a new science of human mind, of human spirit, that he called Dianetics, a sort of therapy and analysis. I'm simplifying, of course, but then there are a thousand sources.
Inverse pseudoscience, I guess.
Well, let's put it like this. Early on, it was labeled as pseudoscientific by US American authorities, and even today it's but with some restrictions, like they have to make it clear that what they are engaging in is like pastoral practice, religious practice, and not really a therapeutic one. And also the doctrine, like what they believe in, includes elements, includes ideas that are at odds, let's say, with real science, with mainstream science. So in this case, we have a new religious movement that claims it is home to a specific science, like they have their own science that they regard as discarded, as marginalized by mainstream science, but that, of course, is labeled by external observers as a pseudoscience.
I'm really interested in knowing about the other ones as well. Maybe some of them, when you are going to define them and we're going to publish the text of this podcast in Arabic, maybe it's going to be the first time someone is writing about this. So.
Sure. Well, the one that lends itself to a comparison with Scientology is the Raelian movement. In this case, we have a new religious movement that was created by someone who claimed he was contacted by aliens, so a contactee. And by the way, there is currently a series on Netflix about humanist movement. So perhaps it is as well known as Scientology is. In this case, like what he claims is that extraterrestrials reveal to him that humanity has been created by them. And humanity has to take on the role as creators, as scientific creators of another race. So we have to work on our scientific progress. And another claim is that especially deserving individuals will have the opportunity to live again on these extraterrestrials' planet, because they will be cloned, like through cloning. So what we have here, especially like compared with Scientology, is a new religious movement that glorifies extant science and in fact makes of it science fiction. Because of course, cloning is not really a way to make yourself immortal. At best, it creates your twin. So this is like real science, but with science fiction infused, and it's a glorification of science as it is externally. It's not like something that the movement claims like they have exclusively, right? And that represents yet another way of conceptualizing the religion science relationship. Then you have a Satanist group. That Satanist group, in fact, was like atheist. So Satan was used as a symbol. And what is interesting is that they engaged in campaigns against pseudoscience and against superstition. Why? Well, because they were opposed to Christianity, to Catholicism in particular, and they conceptualized Catholicism as a superstition, and they used science against it, right? The other new religious movement I studied is Falun Gong, the one that originated in China. It has a very complicated, very complex history, very complex doctrine. It overlaps to some extent with the other movements that I have just mentioned. But in this case, what you have mostly is a master. Also, in this case, you have someone who claims that he has come to a specific doctrine by way of research rather than by way of mere revelation. And on the one hand, he appreciates science. On the other hand, he claims that science and technology are an inferior form of knowledge. Inferior to what? Inferior to his own spiritual doctrine. In fact, he teaches that science and technology were introduced by evil aliens who try to control humanity. So we cannot do without them. We cannot do without science and technology. But at the same time, we have to realize that they are an inferior kind of knowledge and practice in comparison with the spiritual doctrine that he has to teach. And finally, I have been studying Brazilian new religious movement by the name of Santo Daime. To put it in a few words, it's a movement that uses as a sacrament a brew, so a liquid, basically, that they drink during their ceremonies that usually involve singing and dancing, and other ones involve meditation. But the essential component is the consumption of this drink. Now, this drink is hallucinogenic or psychoactive, as in it induces visions. And by the way, I tried it once, like scientific field work. They are very eager to embrace scientific results about, you know, the chemical composition of this liquid, about its effect on human brain. So in that, they are 100% scientific. There is no, I would say, friction of sorts. But at the same time, they claim that the merely scientific interpretation of what this liquid does to human mind, human psyche, is too materialistic. It only stops at a very materialistic conception of human mind, whereas what happens is not just a disruption of ordinary brain chemistry, but it's the unlocking of superior dimensions where human beings can interact with superior beings, can have visions that that teach them like this sort of eternal wisdom. So it's like acceptance of science, but at the same time, they go beyond science. And that's yet another way of conceptualizing the science-religion relationship. And then, of course, there is much more than that. I've been painting a bit black and white. There are overlaps, there are similarities between these movements that we don't have time to talk about now. There are many more new religious movements, but I hope you got a general idea.
Yes, I just have another question that's out of the questions that I was thinking about, which is about this particular drug that they take, to which family of drugs it belongs and what kind of effects it has. The reason I'm asking is that there are the articles we have about some types of drugs, neurosciences, gets many reads, maybe something in the Google search algorithm or something, but many people are interested about these things, although they are not necessarily interested in trying them.
Well, okay, just to put it in a few words, ayahuasca, which is the liquid that is used as a sacrament by daimistas, by those who participate in these rituals, it contains DMT. Then you can find the complete name and the complete explanation in the internet. I mean, I'm no chemist, so I'd rather leave that to an expert. But they would be very unhappy to hear that it is described as a drug, because the definition of a drug, well, it entails that the substance creates, an addiction. You cannot do without it, and you need always greater quantities to obtain the same effect. And Daimistas take issue with this. They claim that ayahuasca does exactly the opposite, and in fact, it helps in drug rehabilitation. They wouldn't call it a drug. They would call it a psychoactive or psychedelic substance.
Yeah, I think we have mentioned the ayahuasca before in some articles in Real Sciences. And it's interesting also about the Raelians that there is a pseudo-scientific concept of the afterlife in their religion. So even in a modern religion, there is this concept invented because apparently people are very interested in this concept. I wanted to ask you about your other book, which we highly recommend reading it, Islam and the Quest for Modern Science. If you can tell us more about this book, but we are more interested in your conversation with Adnan Oktar, and particularly in Arab world, some people don't take him seriously because Adnan Oktar just appears in YouTube, in your Facebook videos, sitting with so many models and talking to them, saying, mashallah, mashallah. And then he doesn't seem to be a scientific or pseudo-scientific figure. So when you talked to him, did you see that he's actually knowledgeable about his topics and his propaganda about evolution? And also, anything we are interested in, anything you want to share about the book or about Adnan Oktar?
Okay, so the book is meanwhile a bit old. I published it 10 years ago. But I think that some sections of it are still valid, can still make for interesting reading. And in fact, I still use it in class. I still use some sections in class with my students. What is it? Well, it's a collection of conversations that I had on Islam and modern science, both with scientists, including, for instance, my good friend Nidal Gassoum, the astrophysicist, and other authors who do not really have, did not really have a scientific education, but that do talk about, or they're not really that knowledgeable about the fields they talk about, but they do talk about Islam and science, and they do sort of shape the public perception. And one of such authors is Adnan Oktar, also known by the pen name of Harun Yahya. Well, meanwhile, he's a bit more difficult to interview because, as far as I know, he's sitting in a jail in Turkey. But back then, I visited him at his villa in Istanbul. And students love when I tell them about what happened that night. Well, for those who do not know about him, he has been an extremely productive, extremely prolific author in the field of Islamic creationism. So basically has been writing and publishing a lot against evolution. But also he has been contributing a lot to Ijaz Ilmi. He has a lot of articles and books about that and other theories, other ideas. And he also had these TV programs that you can still watch, you can still see on YouTube, in which he was interacting with these girls, with these ladies that he was calling his kittens, right? Well, there was an idea behind that. In fact, he was claiming that they were converts, and he was saying things. He was complimenting them along the lines of, "Oh, you are so beautiful, but your beauty is yet another sign of God's power." By the way, I did not meet them at his villa either because there were none that night, or because they weren't that popular yet. But I did meet him after waiting for him. They made me wait for something like 3 or 4 hours, and then we had this interview that was, I would say, a bit clumsy, because he doesn't speak English. He did not speak English. We needed an interpreter, so there was somebody else who would translate the questions, and also I only had 30 minutes. And honestly, the interview was not very deep. Of course, I would have less time than I had for other authors with whom I was communicating directly in English. But in addition to that, I would say that his answers were very dry, right? There was no real depth to them. And it's something that my students never fail to see when we read the interview in class. Then the next question is, do you think that he really believed, or he really believes in what he's saying? That I don't know. That would require me to read thoughts. Well, I do read thoughts to some extent in the classroom, but I'm not that powerful yet.
Yeah, my point is, maybe he's not writing these materials. Maybe he's relying on someone else. Maybe he's just translating.
It has been shown that some of his texts, at least, are nothing but Christian creationist texts that have been translated and peppered with references to Islam, to Allah. But also, he has admitted, and I think... I was also told in the pre-interview phase by one of his assistants that it is no secret that Harun Yahya is actually a pen name, but there is a team. Then who exactly composes that team, we don't know, but it's no secret that the individual Adnan Oktar has not written and perhaps has not read everything that was published by the name of Harun Yahya, for that matter.
What do you mean by elements of religions, religions and science? You mentioned that in two of your books.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's not something that I mentioned. It's the name of the series. You have to know that Cambridge University Press has different series, each one of it, which is called Elements. So each series is supposed to convey like very basic but also scholarly and advanced essential knowledge on a certain topic. So I'm currently co-editing with the astrophysicist Nidal Gassoum a Cambridge University Press Elements series on Islam and the sciences, including a preliminary book, an introductory book authored by Nidal and me. So it's called Islam and Science, Past, Present, and Future Debates. But a couple of years ago, and it was published last year, in fact, I was tasked with writing a book on new religious movements and science for another series that is edited by another professor, Professor Rebecca Moore, although it was founded by the late Professor Jim Lewis, that is about new religious movements. So since I'm an expert in religion and science, I was tasked with writing on new religious movements and science. That's why.
Interesting. There is a very interesting title for one of your papers, which is What Osama Bin Laden Did Not Want to Know. And then our question, as I read the summary, is how to summarize the relationship between religion in general, or Islam, and conspiracy theory, and again, is what is particular for Islam, as we are more interested in writing to an audience that is majorly in Muslim countries.
Okay, look, you are mentioning a paper that I published a couple of years ago, and memory is not. It's no longer that fresh, but basically it has correctly, you cited correctly, it has Osama bin Laden in the title, but it's not about him mainly. It's about an author, it's called Manly P. Hall, who wrote a big book about esotericism that then was said to be located, to be found in Osama bin Laden's library. But in this paper, I argue that it is very unlikely that bin Laden actually read it, and if he came to read it, probably he disagreed with everything that was written in it. But speaking more generally about conspiracy theories, first of all, we have to summarize very quickly what is a conspiracy theory, or what is conspiracist thinking. So conspiracies, as in secret plots, secret plans, have always existed in history, in human history. But conspiracist thinking is a fallacious way of thinking. It's a paranoid, I would say, way of thinking, where people see a conspiracy, and usually a huge, very powerful conspiracy where there is none. So they either misinterpret certain clues to claim that the conspiracy exists, and when they do not find any signs, they also take this as a confirmation, because, of course, the conspiracy is so powerful that they are able to delete any traces, any tracks of their actions and plans, right? And you do find conspiracy theories in the Muslim world the same way you find them in the non-Muslim world, in the Western world. And sometimes they go hand in hand with certain ideas on Islam and science. Because, think of this. Well, we can go back to the example of the splitting moon. So I was asking one of my interlocutors right? Why isn't this this alleged discovery of you know, the signs that the moon was split more widespread? Why doesn't everyone know about this? I mean, if that was really discovered, then we should have been informed. I first heard about it when I was studying Arabic in Alexandria, right? And then, of course, in order to justify this, people, including my interlocutor, will resort to a conspiracy theory. Well, you know, it was discovered, but then NASA thought that that would bring too much credit to Islam, and that's why they have covered it up. So yeah, this is an example of how a conspiracy theory can go hand in hand with a certain kind of idea on Islam and science and modern science.
Nice. I always ask researchers, philosophers, or any guests in Real Sciences podcast about some guidelines, anything they want to say. And here we ask you for something extra to say in Moroccan Arabic as well. So is there anything you want to say to students that study the field, or people who you think they are the right audience for something that you want to share? And again, something in Moroccan Arabic.
Oh, since you are insisting. Okay, well, what should they study? Well, I would say that there are many resources if you're just patient enough to look them up and to actually read them. Of course, one needs to be selective. One needs to be selective and to actually focus on scholarly texts. Because yes, there are 1,000 participants in the debate, but excuse me if I'm very blunt, but there is also a lot of rubbish. There is also a lot of inaccurate information. There are a lot of flawed, fallacious ideas. There is a lot of half-baked material out there. Well, I could recommend the book that Nidal and I just published as a good introduction. It's opinionated at times, as in we give our opinion, we say what we think about certain ideas, but we also provide the readers with an overview of the kind of ideas on Islam and science, including proposed ones that are circulating. And as to something in Arabic, I don't want to disappoint you, but we have been talking for how long so far? I don't know, an hour maybe? So how about we'll just be content with my salama and call this a day?
yeah, I will not ask for more. Thank you very much for all this information. I believe this will be very useful interview to be published both in voice and podcast and in text in our website. You introduced many new things that are introduced in the Arabic web for the first time, even in the English web.
You're very welcome. So shukran zef. And of course, if anyone is interested, they're very welcome to make contact with me as well. They can always send me an email, and I'm always delighted to answer, to exchange ideas or with more recommendations for readings.
Thank you. Thank you. Does that mean that we can put your email within the...
Yes, sure. And it's public. It's public. So
okay. No problem. Thank you very much.
Assalamu
alaikum.